ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
At 17, Chantelle McDougall was nannying for a 36-year-old man. At 20, she was pregnant with his child and swept up in his bizarre spiritual beliefs. At 27, they all disappeared.
I just wished I'd asked a lot more questions no matter what.
I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, The Nan Up 4, a story of control, manipulation and isolation. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. Donald Trump can forgive anyone at all. He's never more like a monarch than when he decides to open prison doors, as he's done for frauds, donors, drug czars and all the louts and thugs who stormed Congress on January the 6th, 2021. Later, we discuss Trump and the pardoning power. Not entirely unrelated, we're looking at the National Anti-Corruption Commission's decision on robo-debt. Despite billions taken unlawfully, lives lost and billions more paid in reparations, the NAC has decided the six key figures involved in the scheme, including Scott Morrison, should go unpunished. Geoffrey Watson, SC, has other ideas. But first, after his victory lap in Australia, Ian Dunt is making his way home, where Prime Minister Keir Starmer has decided to allow US fighter planes to use UK bases to pursue the forever war with Iran.
It's vital that we continue to focus on supporting Ukraine. We cannot allow the war in the Gulf to turn into a windfall for Putin. Now, it's clear the US operation has massively weakened the military capability of the abhorrent regime in Iran. The question is, what comes next?
Well, answer that question, Ian. What does come next, particularly for Starmer and Britain?
Well, I mean, bad things. I mean, the only proper description we can use is bad things, in that Iran has now very clearly and demonstrably recognised that it has powerful leverage as long as it's willing to accept a degree of national self-sacrifice. And by the time that the US purpose in its operation was regime change, and this became an existential crisis for the regime in Tehran, then they very quickly decided that they were prepared to put up with that level of self-sacrifice. And of course, what they've managed to do, basically through belligerence and threats, is close the Strait of Hormuz. And effectively through the impact, emotional and psychological, that those threats have on insurance and on the people on the shipping lanes. And that doesn't really lead you anywhere good. So Donald Trump looks increasingly desperate in his calls for other countries to help get him out of the problem that he has himself begun. And the UK and others, I mean, you know, Japan, Australia, Canada, France, there's really no one stepping up to say, we're going to help you on this particular aspect of what you're trying to do. And yet it's interesting that Donald Trump's emotional outbursts in response to that tend to be pointed more towards Keir Starmer than anyone else. And in fact, reaching a point where you sort of think it's almost like he's becoming his new bête noire. I mean, it's almost like he's becoming his new kind of primary antagonist. He really does seem to be genuinely emotionally upset at the fact that Keir Starmer has refused to do the things that he asked for. And that right there is probably one of the most singular accomplishments that I can make of the British Prime Minister.
But surely this goes to Starmer's standing in Britain.
Yeah, it helps him. I mean, to be honest, this is probably the single, it's almost like he's fallen into it, but it's basically the single most popular policy position he's ever adopted, you know, and it's that you couldn't, he almost seemed surprised. I mean, the first week, he wasn't really making hay out of it. The first week when he basically said, look, you can't use our bases for offensive operations. This was classic sort of, you know, North London lawyer stuff and advised by his attorney general, Richard Hammer, who basically said, look, you can't, it's not illegal. It's obviously not a legal war, so you can't do it. And then the second week they said, you can use it for defensive operations, almost certainly because the legal advice said, you know what, that probably is legal. And so he adopted the position on his instinctive, process-orientated, legalistic interpretation, and then found, you know, was attacked as usual by the right-wing press, by Kevin Badenoch, the Tory leader, by Nigel Farage, the reform leader. And then the next week just found, oh, actually, the public really like this point of view. Like, the public really don't believe in the war in Iran. They think it's a dreadful, shambolic, insane way to have behaved. They like the fact that Britain isn't going to get involved in this one. They generally think you've adopted the right position and that everyone else has adopted the wrong one. And now he's sort of flying. I mean, you know, as far as Starmer goes, this is all comparative, of course. His, you know, his personal approvals are still like, you know, minus 30 or something like that. But nevertheless, he's flying higher than he usually is just by having stumbled into the correct policy position.
But Starmer has allowed the use of UK bases for American planes. Now, what's that about?
Yeah, so this is his core explanation, which is that we will allow for defensive operations. I happen to disagree with this, but let me put the position as it was put to me by those who are more sympathetic, which is essentially to say the US military command operates largely independently from the US political command. They have worked with British forces for decades. If we tell them our red lines, for instance, this can only be used for, you know, defensive operations, no offensive operations, they will stick to those red lines. If Britain doesn't allow for those planes to be operating on a defensive posture, that is essentially saying to our allies in the Middle East, and indeed our own assets in the Middle East, on our own bases in the Middle East, for instance, even outside of the Middle East, even in places like Cyprus, that's essentially saying, well, we're going to leave you as sitting ducks because we happen to disagree with the operation that was taken. Whereas in fact, the position should be, you know, we will make sure that we're protecting our assets. Personally, my view is that I don't think that we should be facilitating any kind of American operations, and that using our own assets is qualitatively different to allowing the US to use ours for what has to be interpreted as a necessary step in their prosecution of the war. But there are a lot of people who oppose the war in general and British involvement in general who do support the Starmer position, both in and out of the Labour Party, and saying that really it's not a very satisfying middle ground that he's occupied in terms of sort of logic or morality, but it is pretty much the only ground he could possibly have found.
Are the far-right parties in the UK, as they are in Australia, essentially arguing that we should send in troops?
Well, initially, yes. So Nigel Farage's first position was, why aren't we supporting the Americans? What have we done to the special relationship? And by the way, it wasn't just him. You look at, you know, magazines like The Spectator saying, you know, this profound day of humiliation for Britain that it wasn't directly involved in the initial attacks. It's worth just thinking for a moment, by the way, about what this means, about just how thin their patriotic veneer so truly is, because they don't even they can't possibly be expecting a decent explanation of why we would be going to war, because none have been provided to the American people, let alone to the British or the Australian people. You know, there are no coherent explanations that are offered to us as to what on earth is going on or what the goals are. So their position on the right is essentially to say, you should join whatever it is that the Americans want you to join, no matter how vulnerable, no matter the impact on, you know, British national security, on the lives of British service personnel. And you should do it without even being able to explain what you're trying to achieve or what the conditions would be by which you would finish the operation. Because, of course, you cannot articulate that because no one told you what we're doing there in the first place. So the right-wing position and patriotic basis, on the basis of the values which it itself is supposed to uphold, has become terribly, terribly weak. And yet it only lasted for that first week, because by the time you got to early March, you already had this very clear sight. The public were against the war. You saw instantly the impact on petrol prices. And suddenly, Nigel Farage, the absolute staggering chutzpah of the man, then comes out and starts saying, well, our new campaign is on why we've got to reduce the price of petrol. And you just think, like, if you had had your way, the price of petrol would be even more out of control than it is right now on the basis of the war that you said we should enter into before you'd even understood what it was that you were talking about. So, I mean, it really is a absolutely ham-fisted, terribly pitiful position that he's put himself in. And on that really core issue of your basic judgment, if you want to be prime minister, on your basic judgment on the biggest matters that a prime minister can make judgments on, he's shown himself to be very weak indeed.
But does this allow Starmer to be more of a leader than he's been before? Is Starmer capable of actually making hay?
Not in the long run. None of this stuff can sort of save him, I don't think. I do think it's almost a sort of a curiosity that he's ended here. And whenever there's another news story that flitters up, for instance, we've got some more details about the Peter Mandelson story this week, where when you looked at the internal documents about Starmer's decision-making, the internal documents, the stuff that was never supposed to come to light, there are just whole areas that he's not saying anything, where he's basically just clearly not involved in the process. He's handed it over, you know, in that case, to his chief of staff. And he's basically this absent man, this sort of clothing without a human body to inhabit it, on a purely administrative level, that corresponds pretty much with the things that seem to make him so ineffective at the job. So the basic personal attributes that he has are still there. The lack of charisma is still there. The sort of sense, that listless feeling of just having no direction, no real core values to guide you, all of that is still there with him. He is still not a good prime minister and will not make one. But on this issue, I think, when his time as prime minister ends, which I still think won't be too long now, this will be one of those issues that we look at and be like, he got that right. And you know what? Something else. None of his immediate predecessors would have got it right. You know, there's no way Rishi Sunak got that right. There's no way Boris Johnson got it right. Liz Truss, probably would have had us launch the nukes. So, on that basis, you sort of think like, thank God, at least now, thank God, he is the person in charge and not any of the other people that we've had for the last 15 years.
But Ian, that photograph of Mandelson sitting around a curiously empty table with Epstein and with Prince Andrew, doesn't it speak well for all three of them? Because you can just see the fun they're having. They don't seem to have a drink in their hands. Some of them have got bathrobes on. Some of them have got clothes. But it just looks such fun, Ian. How can you complain about it?
It's a bit of the trouble is, when you see their emails, you just think these people are just, beyond the obvious moral depravity and corruption, they're just so witless. You know, the emails are just like the worst kind of like round robin joke that he heard somewhere in the office. Just so tedious. And when you see those photos, quite apart from anything else, you just think, I'm sure that conversation was unbelievably tedious for anyone to have had to sit through and wouldn't have been eased in any social way by virtue of the fact that they are wearing bathrobes.
And there is the question of who is taking all these photographs and why?
Yeah.
I mean, are the photographs being taken in order to lock these people in?
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking the same thing. And it's funny how often they seem like they really kind of trap them. Look, I have to put a health warning on this because I have no evidence to show that this is the case. But it's, and of course, the images that we are seeing from the collections are always the ones that are most incriminating and most humiliating, because obviously those are the ones that get the most traction. But it's quite hard to escape that sense that there was a conscious effort to make sure that those kinds of photos were possessed in, you know, just in case these relationships ever became fractious in future.
And I'm sure Donald Trump, amongst all people, is the most unhappy that the war is taking our attention away from the Epstein matter.
Yeah, exactly. And this absurd, now this is such a cliche that it's even become a joke at the Oscar awards, the other night. But essentially to say that, like, at least there is a process happening in Britain to investigate people that are attached to these matters. Whereas in the US, you just get this sense that any kind of basic, consistent, universal application of justice has now crumbled almost completely. And there really is very, very hard for any of them to get any kind of secure purchase on Donald Trump on these matters, even though they directly contradict pretty much all of the statements that he made before he came to power, and indeed any kind of normal moral sense as to how you conduct yourself in public.
Ian, thanks for joining us on the show.
Not at all, thank you.
I've been talking once more to Ian Dunt, columnist with The Eye, author of the book How Westminster Works and Why It Doesn't. Now, coming up, Geoffrey Watson, SC, on the NAC's decision to leave the principal players in robo-debt unpunished. Robo-debt is the greatest public scandal of our time, no contest. With a whiz-bang computer program, the Turnbull and Morrison government supercharged the tired old coalition strategy of accusing the unemployed of ripping off the system. Over 2.5 years, $1.7 billion was taken unlawfully from 470,000 people on government benefits. lives were destroyed, at least three victims suicided. A royal commission in 2023 described Robodebt as an extraordinary saga of venality, incompetence and cowardice. Financial redress of about $2.4 billion has been paid. And now, after much to-ing and fro-ing, the National Anti-Corrupt Commission, the NAC, has delivered its findings on the scheme's six chief players, including Scott Morrison. The recommendation, no punishment. It's so Australian. To discuss, I'm joined by Geoffrey Watson, SC, barrister and director of the Centre for Public Integrity and a fierce critic of the NAC, the Anti-Corruption Commission. Geoffrey, welcome to Late Night Live.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, David.
So the Royal Commission referred to the NAC the cases against six individuals up to their necks in robo-debt. Now, that reference was entirely secret, wasn't it? We didn't know the accusations against them until now.
Well, that's actually right. It was a special closed section of the Royal Commission report. But we now know what was found and what was said about those six people.
But why was it secret? Why couldn't this be known?
Well, that was a decision of the Royal Commissioner that this matter would be referred on to NAC. And the Royal Commission handed down its report in 2023. I imagine that the Royal Commissioner felt that NAC would move with similar efficiency to the efficiency she had shown and have their report out in no time at all. So I don't think she thought that it would be buried for 3 years.
Even the identities of the six were secret, right?
Yes.
But of course we could guess that they would include the minister responsible for the scheme, Morrison, and the chief bureaucrat responsible for the scheme,
Catherine Campbell.
Catherine Campbell. And that indeed proved to be true. So let's go back to the beginning of the scheme. How was it supposed to work?
Well, it was as a matter of probabilities, so that instead of looking at individual cases, a computer program picked up and analysed tax records, and if you were shown to have earned a particular amount of money, which would otherwise, on the face of it, disqualify you from social securities, the program turned around and converted that into a debt. Now, that worked completely unfairly. Let me give you the most simplistic example. If you had a very well-paid job for 6 months in a year, but then lost that job and became entitled to unemployment benefits, under this program, it would look back and say, oh, hold on, during that year, paying no attention to the fact that you'd earned it in half a year, in that year you earned $75,000. You were not entitled to unemployment benefits. You were then issued with a notice which took the form of a debt owed to the Commonwealth for the whole of the social securities you'd received.
So if you got one of these notices, it was up to you to disprove it. They didn't have to prove a debt. It was up to you to disprove it.
Yes. And a lot of people who got it, we've got first-hand accounts. They didn't know why they were getting it. Some of them were outraged. Some of them realised it was an administrative error. But the group who was getting them were unusually vulnerable. They were people on social securities. Maybe they didn't have friends who were lawyers. Maybe they didn't have access to external assistance. And so they were getting these notices, and you can imagine the impact it would feel. I know how I would feel if I got a notice from the Commonwealth government saying that I owed a large sum of money, tens of thousands of dollars.
Particularly if you were, at the time, on unemployment benefits.
Particularly
how on
if you didn't have the money.
Do you repay it? So the notion was that if you earned a bit of money in the year, it was averaged out over the whole year, and these were, and it was declared that you owed money.
Exactly. And that, you can see, is just obviously prone to unfairness.
Prone to unfairness or not, even more obvious it would seem to me is that a brand new way of approaching getting government debts repaid, a brand new way, everybody would be asking themselves, do we need fresh legislation to do this?
Oh, they were asking that question. Many, many people were asking that question. It was even called, it started in 2015, it was even given a title, the New Policy Proposal. So everybody knew that it was new. The question was it permissible within the existing statutory framework?
Absolutely fundamental question. New scheme, do we have to legislate for it? Did anybody say they did have to legislate for it, Geoffrey?
Yes, plenty of people did. For example, some lower-level bureaucrats thought it should. Some external lawyers, and this is a real problem here, not the government lawyers, the AGS, but external law firms had said, yes, you need new legislation, or it's not consistent with the current legislation, or it's illegal under the current legislation. So people were asking these questions.
But which people? Oddly enough, it didn't seem to include the minister, Mr. Morrison, or the head of the department, Ms. Campbell, or, it would seem, the cabinet.
Well, hold on. You're now reciting the findings of the NAC as opposed to the findings of the Royal Commissioner, Chief Justice Holmes.
I'm guilty of that. Distinguish the two, sir.
Chief Justice Holmes actually made these six referrals on the basis of findings that she had made that these questions had arisen and that people, for example, Morrison, knew enough to be asking these questions. I can explain exactly how that worked in practice. But the findings by Commissioner Holmes, if we just focus on Mr. Morrison, they're pretty serious. So she found that he knew that averaging robo-debt was a bad scheme which didn't work, that he was the responsible minister for administering the scheme lawfully, that he was warned that it had been unlawful to introduce it, that Morrison omitted to tell the committee, the Expenditure Review Committee of Cabinet, that fact, and in doing so, he misled Cabinet, either deliberately or perhaps maybe through omission. That is pretty serious stuff. The Royal Commissioner went on to find that Mr. Morrison had given untrue evidence to the Royal Commission on a critical issue about what he was told about established practices. Now, that's one set of findings.
Which we now know for the first time.
Yes. So if NAC's report has done one good thing, we now know what these findings were, and they are really very serious. Now, as it turns out, the Assistant Commissioner at the NAC, Kylie Kilgour, did not agree. In fact, in opposition, preferred her own inferences or was really unwilling to draw certain conclusions and came to different views about it.
So now we're moving on from the Holmes report, which was the Royal Commission, to the Kilgour report, which is the NAC's work.
Yep, and that's why I pulled you up before, because it's not really as though we've got the final word on this. What we've got is, in practical terms, a different outcome from a different person. One, Chief Justice Holmes from Queensland, and the other, Assistant Commissioner Kylie Kilgour.
Which of the two do you think displayed a better understanding of the public service?
I'm reluctant to really get into the personalities and I don't wish to be critical, but I will say this. The Royal Commission report was thorough, it was careful, it was comprehensive, and I saw no reason to doubt any part of it. I was disappointed that there was a sealed section. I thought we should know that too, but I trust the Chief Justice's judgment in keeping that from us. And also, there's something else here, David, which I think we might need to return to. I was also able to watch the Royal Commission proceedings as they unfolded. They were conducted in public, and I could see it. Meanwhile, Commissioner Kilgour, very accomplished person, conducted her part of the inquiry in closed session. We didn't get to see it. We see reasons why Catherine Holmes didn't believe Mr. Morrison, and we also got the opportunity to watch him giving his evidence. Meanwhile, Commissioner Kilgour has believed Mr. Morrison, expressly said that, but unfortunately, I didn't get to see how he gave that evidence. I could make no independent judgment of it.
The NAC has been much criticised for its reluctance to interview people in public, but there is a clause there that allows them under certain circumstances to do so. I would have thought, correct me if I'm wrong, that that interrogating a former prime minister about a scandal of this dimension would open the door to those rare public interrogations.
Yes, well, I don't think they should be that rare, but accepting for the moment that the legislation says that they can only occur in exceptional circumstances, one of the governing factors you take into account is the public interest. Can anybody tell me of a more central public interest than finding out what happened in this terrible scheme, in this terrible administrative error, by a minister who later became Prime Minister of the nation? In fact, if you look at the report of the NAC, it's called Operation Myrtleford. It's on their website. Anybody can look at it and see that the last 10 or so pages explain why there were no public hearings. You could read those, I read them, and think the reasons given were good reasons why there should have been a public hearing. It was a matter of heightened public interest.
They proved the contrary case.
They do. I mean, I read them and I thought every single reason they're suggesting that it should be heard in public are precisely the reasons why it should have been heard in public.
There is some good come of this. This is not... the NAC report, for all the criticisms that we and other people have been making of it, at least the thing is done now. But is it done satisfactorily?
Oh, no. Not to me. I don't feel like it's satisfactory at all. In fact, I've just got a lingering worry about this. I look at this terrible scandal and think hardly anybody has suffered for it except for the victims. If I look at the career of Catherine Campbell, who was the subject of very scathing findings by Commissioner Holmes, Catherine Campbell received a promotion, a high promotion.
And yet the Kilgour report exonerates Catherine Campbell to some extent on the grounds that she had nothing to gain from pleasing the minister or pleasing the government. She gained spectacular promotion.
Yes. It's actually quite interesting. Maybe this is just the nerd emerging in me, but when I looked at the report, I couldn't help but notice this constant obsession with looking for whether or not somebody had a motive. So that I checked on, I did just this morning, I checked on how many times the word motive was used. It was used 14 times in the report, and most of the findings have got a section titled motive. And the commissioner, Kilgour, was looking for motives. Well, we know from lots of experience, hundreds of years' experience in this instance, that looking for a motive can be quite deceptive, that if there is an obvious motive, well, that sort of proves it. But the criminal law says that motive is never an essential element, and that applies with equal force to statutory corruption. So let's put it aside. That's deceptive. Yet, if you look everywhere in the report, there are findings, well, there was no motive. And Catherine Campbell got the benefit of that. Well, excuse me, but I tend to think the opposite. The word fear is used 18 times, and it's used constantly in the context of people in the public servants who feared the consequences of not going along with what people wanted to have known. In other words, it was a culture. Between those two things, you can get motive, if you ask me. And also, the job to which Catherine Campbell was promoted at the end of all of this paid in excess of $1 million per annum. Oh, well, you know, maybe it's the cynic in me, but I do sense the potential for a motive.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Geoffrey Watson about the latest round of the Robodebt scandal, it being the report by NAC. Geoffrey, what does this report tell you about the future of NAC?
I've written about this, I've spoken about this, I think, on this program.
This is not your first rodeo on Late Night Live.
Yes. The point is this, that the culture comes from the top. At the moment, I just see everything about the NAC demonstrating that it is defensive, it's legalistic, it's very wary of making an error. Now, I can understand that.
They're all good things, are they not?
All good things and human things. But there is a problem with that. These sorts of agencies, it's very important that they are robust, that they are tough, that they are ready to lock horns with the rich and powerful. That's who they're mainly investigating. And what's more, they've got to be willing to have challenges made to it in courtrooms. That's just part of the job.
Could I put it another way, that they have to be real world?
This is public sector corruption. David, without a doubt, the single most serious crime in the world today. For example, the international drug trade doesn't get off the ground without public sector corruption. To investigate public sector corruption, you need special powers, special skills, and you need to be tough and you need to be hard and you need to go after your targets. Everything about the knack that I've seen seems to suggest that it's supine and reactive and wishes to take a conservative line when a more aggressive line is open. Now, I'm not just talking about this report. I'm talking about things which I've seen in print, which are meetings of the NAC executive over which Commissioner Brereton presided, in which they expressed to me a misunderstanding of the jurisdiction. I should say I was there in the room when this jurisdiction was being drawn up.
Right.
It came as a surprise to me, and I rang some of the other people and discussed with them these minutes. We couldn't understand where this was coming from. And I've also written about this, but the Deputy Commissioner, Nicole Rose, gave evidence at the Senate estimates, which to me suggested that it was an organisation which was very scared of stepping out of line with testing its boundaries. I'm very disappointed at that. But if you ask me, that comes from the top. That's the culture created by the leader.
What about its legislation?
So there's nothing wrong with its legislation in my book, except for the clog on public hearings, which are
right. So the machinery is okay, except for that.
Could I tell you, I was there, we were proffering these matters as design, except for that clog on the conduct of public hearings. The designers, we were getting everything we wanted, including really good funding. So it is a properly funded, properly skilled investigative body, and at the moment, I think, just lacking in leadership.
Geoffrey, thanks very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
You know, it's my pleasure. Thank you, David.
I have been talking to Geoffrey Watson, campaigner against corruption, campaigner for more effective corruption commissions, barrister and director of the Centre for Public Integrity. Coming up, we're amateurs. American presidents exonerate on an industrial scale. Donald Trump has pardoned all the thugs who stormed Congress, even those who bashed up the cops, all home free after one of the biggest investigations and mass prosecutions in American history. He's even sprung from prison the former Honduran president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, serving a 45-year sentence for, amongst other things, dispatching 400 tons of cocaine to the United States. This power to pardon goes back, of course, to the earliest days of the Republic, that strange republic that gave its president so many of the powers of a monarch, including the royal prerogative of mercy. Professor Saikrishna Prakash, a distinguished legal scholar at the University of Virginia, has just published an important book on this strange aspect of the United States Constitution. It's called The Presidential Pardon, The Short Clause with a Long, Troubled History. Sai joins us from Virginia. Welcome to Late Night Live.
It's a pleasure to be with you, David.
Sai, you write that America has now reached a position of pardon dystopia. What do you mean by that?
What I mean, David, is that presidents are now using pardons as instruments of politics rather than as instruments of mercy or national reconciliation. So they're running on promises of giving pardons to their supporters. They're giving pardons to campaign contributors and business associates. Of course, they're giving pardons to family members. And so they're using a pardon power that's supposed to be used for purposes of state building and mercy to further their own political interests.
And this is new?
It's always been there in the background. There's always been suspicions about this, going back to John Adams, where he pardoned a bunch of rebels in Pennsylvania, and people thought he was doing so in part because he wanted to get more votes in Pennsylvania. And then, you know, there have been other examples. Andrew Johnson issued a pardon on the first day of the Democratic National Convention, and he was told that if he gave a pardon, he was more likely to get the nomination. He didn't get the nomination, but he clearly timed the pardon for the first day of the convention. And then, of course, Bill Clinton issued pardons to a campaign contributor, or more precisely a presidential library donor, Mark Rich, and pardoned several groups that were useful to Hillary Clinton's campaign for Senate. Joe Biden ran on a marijuana pardon, but Trump is taking this to a new level.
Those 20 words in the Constitution, why were they put there in the first place? Because I take it from what you write that there were those worried about it from the start.
Yes. So, you know, every legal system has a regime or a mechanism by which they can mitigate or eliminate the penalties associated with violating the law. The idea is that some people deserve mercy because it turns out they were innocent or because they've lived exemplary lives since their punishment or since they were put in prison. Sometimes there's a need for reconciliation, say if there's a rebellion. This was certainly a feature of the English pardon power, where the crown would periodically have to issue an amnesty to pacify a rebellion. And when the founders thought about pardons, they were familiar with them because they came from Great Britain as a, you know, we were all colonies before we were states and a nation. So it was just natural to have a pardon power, and the question was how it would be vested. And they thought on balance it worked better to give it to one person rather than, say, giving it to the legislature to exercise, because back then the legislature wasn't always in session. And I think the thought was rebels aren't going to lay down their arms if they have to wait for the legislature to issue the pardon. They will lay them down if the president promises them a pardon. So I think they just thought it would be better vested in one person's hands.
And the words are, he shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offences against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. But say, this power in the United Kingdom was exercised on the advice of the government. It wasn't personally held by the monarch. But of course, the United States doesn't have a government. In that British sense. So it's a personal power, much stronger than it ever was in Britain. Is that right?
Well, I think, you know, the British Constitution changed over time. Obviously, today the Crown is more of a figurehead, a head of state, rather than someone who wields real authority. But I think in the 17th and 18th century, the Crown did issue pardons without regard to any advice they might get from their ministers.
Yeah.
So there was this tradition, at least in the 16th century and earlier, I forgot when it ended, maybe the 17th, of coronation pardons. When monarchs came into, when they were crowned, they would issue a coronation pardon as a means of celebration. And this was just a regular staple of British policy for a long time. And they would exclude various really heinous offenses, but back then, lots of offenses were punished with death, even what we would consider minor offenses. I don't know at what point the ministers exercised an effective veto on the Crown's pardons, but I'm not sure it was until, you know, I don't think it was until later, maybe after the U.S. Constitution.
Right, but once again, the British system shows its strength by not being written down. and therefore able to evolve. I hadn't realized until I read your book that pardons come in different forms. Tell us about the various forms of pardons that the US president can grant.
So the Constitution mentions pardons and reprieves. A pardon is a full grant of mercy. It sort of effaces the conviction and eliminates any consequences from the conviction. A reprieve is just a temporary respite in the punishment, right? If you're about to face an execution, you might be given a reprieve, and then the execution won't take place until and unless the reprieve is lifted, or, you know, you might get a pardon, in which case there'll never be an execution. Those are mentioned in the Constitution, but the language reprieve and pardon is taken to mean that the president can also issue a commutation, which is basically reducing the sentence or reducing the fine. You may have received a 10-year sentence from a judge, and maybe the president will reduce it to 2 years. You may have received a $1 million fine from the court, and the president might reduce it to $10,000. So that's what's called a commutation. You know, another form of clemency would be an amnesty, and an amnesty is a grant of some form of clemency to multiple people, often thousands, all at once. And you've just sort of described the offenses and described the category of people that will receive it. And that's the kind of clemency that you would see in the wake of a rebellion or in the wake of widespread lawlessness or violation. So Jimmy Carter pardoned draft dodgers in 1977 because he thought it was time to put the Vietnam War behind us. You know, Andrew Johnson and Abraham Lincoln pardoned a lot of the Confederates.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what Trump did in the wake of, you know, on January 20th when he resumed the presidency for a second time.
And there are conditional pardons that exempt people from punishment as long as he or she, I suppose, lives a clean life of some kind, but conditions are placed on a pardon.
Yeah, you can put conditions that are, you know, that you have to satisfy first and or conditions you have to satisfy for the duration of your life, or you can put them both, right? So for a rebellion, what you would say is you've got to lay down your arms and you get a pardon and you've got to be, you have to continually be peaceable, right? Because they don't want you to take them up again. And so there's a condition precedent and a condition subsequent. Sometimes the conditions are you just have, you know, maybe you have to admit your guilt and you get a commutation, or, you know, you have to do something in return for getting the commutation or the pardon. And, or as you said, you have to do something, you have to refrain from doing something going forward. And of course, that raises the possibility of all kinds of conditions being placed that one might think are nefarious, right? So,
yes, yes. But the fabulous thing I've discovered from you is that a grant can't be undone, a little mistake that Donald Trump made.
I'm not sure what you're referring to, David. Did Donald Trump try to retract a pardon?
He tried to retract all the pardons that Biden had granted.
Well,
discovered he couldn't. Poor man.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump's theory of that case is that Biden didn't make the pardons. And of course, if Biden didn't, you know, issue the pardons, Trump wouldn't need to retract them. They wouldn't be valid, right? If let's imagine that, you know, Joe Smith was the one who actually issued the pardons in Biden's name and Biden had nothing to do with them. Well, then there would be no retraction because they just were never valid to begin with.
Of course.
The problem with Trump's theory is that he wants to say that Joe Biden wasn't mentally fit to issue the pardons. And that's never been tested before. I suppose it's true that if, you know, Joe Biden was in a coma and they used, you know, they manipulated his hand to sign a bunch of pardons, those wouldn't be valid. But in the absence of some compelling evidence that Joe Biden didn't issue those pardons, it's just talk on the president's part. And it's further kind of talk because unless the president's going to try to jail those people or prosecute them, it doesn't matter, right? In other words, a pardon has a practical effect in the real world if the executive just chooses not to prosecute someone because they think this person has a valid pardon. So if Trump was really serious, he would try to put these people in jail or prosecute them. They would then raise their pardon, and then we would find out. But he's not doing any of that, right? It's just a way of...
It's talk.
It's a way of diminishing President Biden, but nothing's going to come of it as far as I can tell.
On Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. And I'm talking to Sai Prakash about his history of the use of the pardon in America. Sai, let's go right back to the beginning. When was the first pardon granted? By whom? Why?
So Washington is the first pardoner because he's the first president and he's getting petitions for pardons. And Washington is, you know, my sort of ideal pardoner-in-chief, the ideal, you know, issuer, dispenser of
mercy.
You
write about him in the most glowing terms, yes.
Well, he's a wonderful president and, you know, I think an exemplary person. So what he does is he gets the input of the prosecuting attorney, the judge. He, of course, reads the petition for a pardon by the prisoner who wants the pardon. And then he mulls it over and he really thinks long and hard about it and he comes to a decision. And, you know, he has more time in that era. There are fewer people who have been convicted. He, of course, is the first president. And so there isn't a backlog of pardon applications like there is today. But he takes it very seriously, and he's doing this all himself. And, you know, he's looking for advice. And then his pardons, they're public documents. They actually say, you know, greetings to all whom see these presents, greetings. You know, and then he describes who he's pardoning, for what offenses, and then he critically tells you why he's pardoning them. He tells you, I think this person is innocent, or I think they've, you know, repented, or I think, you know, they've already been punished sufficiently. Because he knows that these are public records and they're public, he wants to give public sounding reasons, not have it just be viewed as some arbitrary process on his part. So Washington is the first person to do it.
But the habit of giving reasons and setting it all out in public has long gone.
Well, there's you know, they're often saying something in these pardons, but the president, it's very hard for the president to review the thousands of applications that are given to them today, and they're not really preparing, you know, the language of the pardon. And so it's other people that are preparing memos and lists of people that they think ought to be pardoned, and the president then reviews those lists, and then someone else is preparing the pardon and giving reasons. You know, famously, when Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, he gives about 24 reasons because he knows it's going to be controversial. It's just more reasons than you can possibly imagine. And Joe Biden gives reasons for pardoning his family. It's just that, what you know, one sometimes doubts the reasons that are publicly stated in a way that I don't think is true for Washington. Part of that is, I guess, my cynicism of, you know, the reasons that people give today as opposed to the past. But, you know, I suppose in the future someone might think that Trump or Biden, you know, are the ideals of, you know, they're the ideal states of it. I can't see it happening, but it's possible.
You actually admire the pardon that Ford gave Nixon, very, very controversial pardon. There was a huge appetite to see Nixon prosecuted after Watergate. Why do you think that was ultimately a good thing?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, there were allegations or suspicions that there was a corrupt bargain that Nixon would resign in return for making Ford president, and then Ford would, you know, pardon Nixon. I don't think any such deal was made. And so when Ford is pardoning Nixon, I think he really believes that it's best for the nation to put the episode behind us. And I think all I meant to say is that I think he was sincere in doing that. It's a harder question to answer whether or not Nixon should have been prosecuted. But I think what I was trying to say was that I trust Ford's motives. And in fact, you know, he suffered, I think, quite a bit for issuing the pardon, something that you wouldn't do if you thought, you know, you might not pardon someone if you thought you would suffer for it, unless you think perhaps that it's better for the country. So it's not clear that Ford ever recovered from that pardon.
Let me engage your lawyer's mind. Here's my scenario. 2 days before the end of his term, Donald Trump stands down and is replaced, if only for 2 days, by J.D. Vance as president. Vance then pardons Trump for everything he's done, perhaps in both terms as president, and those pardons protect Trump forever. Would that work?
So this was actually discussed by the Nixon lawyers. They said that Nixon could not pardon himself, but they said he could step down. They said temporarily he could step down temporarily, and then Ford could pardon him, and then Nixon could resume the office. I think, you know, it sounds terrible, and I think it would be terrible because it would seem as if he was resigning only to get the pardon, obviously. But I think that's possible. Yes, I think I think it would be legally effective. I think it would spur a reform. You know, Trump has a grip on the Republican Party, but all grips on parties by presidents decline over time, right? The Democrats recently kind of jettisoned President Clinton. They don't care that he's being forced to testify before Congress. Many of them voted against him. And at some point, Trump's grip will decline on the Republican Party, and then maybe they will decide that this is just a terrible idea. Terrible for the vice president to pardon the president, you know, because the vice president is obviously beholden to the president. The president chooses the vice president.
It would look squalid. Do legal scholars like yourself, perhaps even a wider range of people in the United States, think that perhaps it'd be a good idea to just start all over again with a new constitution? You know, start from scratch and fix all this up. What about that as an idea?
Well, I think opening up the entire constitution might prove more daunting and more difficult than just amending the pardon clause. So I think you're right that there are people in the United States who believe that the Constitution is outdated. Others, you know, believe it ought to be changed in certain respects. But if you reopen the entire thing, you run the risk that it gets opposed by powerful interests such that nothing gets changed. It might be easier to change it on a piecemeal basis.
I'm a utopian, you see. I'm filled with large dreams. But let's just look at the clause itself, the pardons clause. Is there any political will to just get rid of it?
Well, I think there are some people who are talking about it now, even more so than, you know, when I finished the book. I think the problem is that there are other people who think that criminal punishments are too harsh, and they like the fact that the president can mitigate them, right? There are some people who want more pardons, not less. They want less pardons that are partisan or political or designed to further the president's interests. They want more pardons or commutations that will lessen the harshness or the severity of, you know, federal laws. And if you want that, diminishing the president's power would be counterproductive unless you have some other mechanism for, another body to issue pardons. And so the book discusses reforms, perhaps making it harder for the president to pardon, perhaps giving other people the power to pardon, maybe a House of Congress or, you know, a body of experts who would wield the pen. Because it was easier to get a pardon in the 18th and 19th century because there were fewer people and fewer pardon petitioners. Now it's really hard because there's so many people who have been found guilty of a federal offense. And of course, as the book notes, you don't even have to be prosecuted to receive a pardon. The president can pardon you in advance of any prosecution.
Do we have any idea how long the queue is at the moment? How deep the documents are on the pardons office desk?
Yeah, I think what's happened is the pardon office sends candidates to one of the attorney generals, the deputy attorney general, and they forward it on to the White House. And my recollection is it's several thousand people long. And part of what's going on is, you know, presidents don't mind pardoning their friends and family and political allies. They are more concerned about pardoning someone else they don't know who then goes and commits a crime because they will be held responsible for it. And so, you know, there's a certain reluctance to use a pardon pen for people who don't have connections to the White House, right? One of the themes of the modern presidency is if you know someone in the White House, your chances of getting a pardon are astronomically higher.
And haven't we read reports that some of those pardoned after storming Congress have committed fresh crimes?
Well, I think there are people that, you know, have received a pardon and have committed other crimes. Yes, most certainly. And, you know, I think there are people that have received two pardons. They got pardoned during the first Trump administration, and I think they've received another pardon for another crime they committed or were prosecuted for during the Biden administration. And, of course, people believe in mercy, but you might wonder whether, you know, other people were more worthy of mercy than the person who had already committed an offense and been pardoned for it once.
Cy, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It's been a pleasure.
I've been talking to Professor Cy Prakash, distinguished legal scholar at the University of Virginia, about his book on the history of pardons, the presidential pardon, the short clause with a long, troubled history. This is Late Night Live. And that's the show. Tomorrow, Late Night Live takes a close look at Pauline Hanson and the challenge she presents for politics in Australia today. We're bringing Paul Kelly, Nikki Saba, Anthony Green into the studio to examine Hanson's rise, fall, and now meteoric rise again. There's been a lot of speculation about what this means for Australia. We bring the good oil.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.